Welcome to The Right Angle. The Right Angle is a new podcast from the Wisconsin Assembly Republican Caucus featuring conversations between lawmakers and policy experts, whether that means national scholars or the folks on the ground moving Wisconsin forward every day. Today, we are featuring a conversation between Representative Rob Sommerfeld of the 67th Wisconsin Assembly District and Chair of the Assembly Committee on Medicaid Reform and Oversight, and Ben Ippolito, a research fellow in economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Ben's recent work has focused on the behavior of healthcare providers, price regulation, and healthcare financing. With Wisconsin going into a new budget round and healthcare always being a top priority for both Republicans and Democrats, it's a great time to be sitting down and talking about what works for healthcare, how we can move Wisconsin's healthcare policy forward on a bipartisan basis, and how we can make sure we've got funding for all of our priorities. Here is a great conversation on how that looks from both a national and a state perspective.
Welcome, Ben.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, just want to give us a little background on your background, I guess, and just kind of tell, you know, what policy that you've been studying and got your doctorate in, and we'll go from there.
Well, I suppose I should start with the fact that I'm a former Badger, although I suppose I should consider myself a Badger for life. But I got my PhD in economics at UW-Madison, and I've studied public economics, but mostly healthcare. And so I'm a researcher at the American Enterprise Institute, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C., and I research a variety of issues from Medicaid financing and healthcare financing more broadly to the effects of various incentives on behavior of all sorts of market actors in healthcare. And so I've managed to touch on a fairly broad range of things, though there's always more to learn, I suppose.
Yeah. Do you miss the Wisconsin winters at all? Just had to ask because it's been a long winter up here.
I haven't forgotten them. Let me say that.
That is good. Yeah, once again, thank you for joining us on this podcast. I guess we'll start, you know, big picture. Where do you see healthcare going in the next couple years?
Well, when I look at healthcare at a high level, I think there's one question that we have yet to really tackle that's going to take a lot of the focus in Washington and at the state level, and that's healthcare costs. So we're very good in this country of subsidizing healthcare. We do it in a variety of ways, be it through the Medicaid program, where we let states decide how these programs are run, and the federal government just subsidizes it forever. We have these open-ended subsidies on the Obamacare exchanges or for employer-sponsored insurance. But we're not very good at controlling costs. And so what's happened over the last 30, 40 years or so is that our healthcare costs in this country have really grown relative to just about any other country out there. And so we as a country now spend about $3.5 trillion a year on healthcare. That's about 18% of our GDP as a country. And so whether you're left, right, or center, at some point, we're going to have to make a decision that we don't want to spend every dollar we have on healthcare. And so we're going to have to come up with ways to actually tackle that problem. And so when I look at the political dynamics and the political realities of how this is going to go forward, I think you're going to have two camps. One which says that the government at the end of the day is the best position to control costs and decide what's best for people. And one side that's going to say, no, actually, we really want to use competitive forces and use consumer choice to try and discipline the market as best we can. And so that, I think, is going to be the ebb and flow of the next few election cycles, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of touch on that. You know, with the camp, with the government being involved, it sounds easy. It sounds like, hey, this is a simple thing. We'll just turn around, let the government take, you know, care of this. What are the major disadvantages going down that path?
Well, sure. So I think it's easiest to think about this with some sort of concrete proposal in mind. So perhaps the most relevant one is to think about one end of the spectrum, which is which I would define by as the Bernie Sanders end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. where the idea is for a very serious Medicare for all approach, where Medicare for all would be something that we call Medicare, but would in fact be much more generous than than the current Medicare program, and everyone would get it, and nobody would ever have to worry about paying for any care on the margins. Yeah, as you say, I don't think anyone can listen to that and say, "Gee, that doesn't that sounds pretty good to me." You know,
yep.
there's a lot of nice features to that. The unfortunate part is that there are some realistic challenges that come with that. The first is, we already have a Medicare system that is not on solid footing, right? We have Medicare spending that the CBO is projecting to grow to close to 20% of federal outlays in the next 10 years. That's a huge program growing at a rate that is not sustainable. The idea of making it more generous and then expanding even further is problematic. And so it doesn't seem like they've done a terribly good job at actually controlling costs. Moreover, if you go down this route where there's only one choice, it's really a problem, because what happens if you don't like the one option that's available? What happens if 10 or 15 years from now, someone gets elected that you don't like? And for many Medicare for All supporters, I'd point to the current administration, where I would suspect that's not the administration they would want running the only health insurance plan that's available to all Americans. And so choice and the idea of having some competition, even if it's even if the government does have some role in regulating the competition in healthcare, having choices is a very, very powerful tool that allows consumers to clearly indicate their preferences in a very clear, direct, and rapid way. Whereas going down the route of a single payer type system means you're only able to affect these things through these very long and uncertain election processes. So I think that's one of the big, big things that many of the supporters for Medicare for All overlook, or at least minimize a little bit.
In my backyard, 90 miles from my house, is the Mayo Clinic, you know, a world-renowned clinic, huge in the research, you know, on the cutting edge of developing cures, you know, research. You know, what would that mean for them in the long haul with a single payer?
Well, it's a good question, and I think I would answer it by going back to just the way that some of these plans are sold. So the way you often hear single payer sold is that they'll say, look, we've got a bunch of insurance companies out there right now who make all sorts of profits, and they have these administrative costs of running these systems. If we had Medicare for All, we could get rid of all that. The government doesn't need to make a profit. That's true. But the problem is that there's not nearly enough money in those kind of savings to actually fund a system like that. And so instead, most of the funding comes from very large payment reductions to providers. And now, I would certainly not want to argue that there are no payments that we could reduce and perhaps improve American healthcare. I, in fact, think there are a ton. However, there's a big difference between that and slashing every rate down to the Medicare rate. And just to hammer this home, so the Mayo Clinic, and you know, even just the average hospital, the private insurers that are coming to that hospital are paying close to double what Medicare is paying. And so when you think about what would this mean in the long run, I think the simple answer is that the Medicare you see today gets to benefit greatly from all of those other payers who are paying a lot more. So under Medicare for All, Medicare would look quite different than it does right now, namely because that cross-subsidization really wouldn't be there from all the other private payers.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, excellent points. And then you said the second group, that the competitive, the open markets. How should us as policymakers, and talking with our constituents, what would be some suggestions to go down that route?
So I think we want to think about, how the heck do we get consumers to have choices that are meaningful? And I really want to emphasize the meaningful part of that. You know, I like consumer choice. I like markets, but I don't like choice because, you know, I just like making choices all day. In fact, you know, to a point, there's a cost to making a choice. You got to think about a new issue or whatever. But the real advantage of choice is that it's very easy for consumers, for individuals, to signal to companies, this is what I like. This is what I don't like. Even if it takes a year to learn, hey, I didn't like my insurance plan last year, but you know what? I noticed there's another option for me. Maybe I'll give that one a shot. Companies respond to that kind of incentive. They respond to those kinds of choices. And so I really think that one of the things I try and emphasize is, you know, the idea of having a more market-oriented healthcare system is not about, you know, making consumers think about more complicated things. It's not about them having to make more choices or, you know, face what seems to many can be a daunting task of choosing your insurance every year and so on. but rather how do we make it so that we can present some simple choices that allow them to tell providers what they want and what they don't want. And I think that's the core message that I try and emphasize and I try and work towards when I think about policies.
Yeah. Is there some specific policies, kind of more or less low-hanging fruit, that could start to revamp the system that in the long run end up with better quality for less costs?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was actually I've been thinking about this issue quite a bit recently because myself and some of the scholars here at the American Enterprise Institute worked with scholars at the Brookings Institution, which is a moderate liberal think tank, a prominent think tank here in D.C. And we were working together to respond to Senator Lamar Alexander, who is the chairman of the Senate Help Committee. And he asked for expert recommendations on what are some bipartisan things we can do to meaningfully lower healthcare spending in this country. And I think I came away from that experience quite emboldened, just because, like you say, there's more low-hanging fruit than you would believe if you listen to the rhetoric that comes out of, frankly, either party. And so, you know, without getting into the, you know, too far into the weeds, there are a number of proposals that are actually quite related to those of the current administration, related to how we pay for drugs in the Medicare program. We can do a much better job of encouraging competition in Medicare's Part B and Part D. We can improve the way that enrollees, Medicare enrollees, pick their plans, so we make it easier for them to indicate which ones they like, which ones they don't like. Not necessarily on that list. When I look at programs over the long run, I think programs like Medicaid, at a certain point, we are going to have to revisit those programs and the financing designs of them. Right now, what we do as a country is we say, heck, the federal government, they'll subsidize this thing as long as you want. So go ahead and keep spending. And if we want to limit, spending at some point, we've got to impose constraints that exist in every other market. We can't pretend they don't exist. And so I think when I think about the market, I think about how can we encourage more competition for pharmaceuticals, for providers? How do we revamp the Medicaid and Medicare programs to introduce some cost discipline so that we don't encourage endless spending? But I still say there's more room for agreement than you would think that there is.
Those are great thoughts. Kind of backing up again, in your opinion, with the federal government, the deficits and all this, if you can continue talking about going down the Bernie Sanders type, how long is even Medicare, all these other programs before they're on the chopping block? I mean, is a couple bad economy or a couple downturns in the economy, a recession here too, that in, 4 or 5 years or less than that, that we have the federal government's going to say, we're even going to cut our payments back to state even more?
Oh, there's no question. Those kind of considerations are something that I think state policymakers need to be thinking about. They need to be thinking about these partnerships with the federal government. They may not go on forever. Now, it's hard to cut these programs. Mm-hmm. But having said that, when you look at the growth rates of Medicaid, Medicare, and then Social Security, those three being the most important ones, they're clearly on an unsustainable path. And now, as you say, when you talk about things like Medicare for All, in order to fund Medicare for All, as proposed by Bernie Sanders, the federal government, forget what we're currently spending, over the next 10 years, they'd have to raise $32 trillion more dollars in taxes. All right, that is an unprecedented amount of money. And so even if you include all of the funding sources that Senator Sanders has proposed, he's still $15 or $20 trillion short of actually financing a program like that. And so for somebody who cares about responsible spending, and I certainly would count myself as one of those people, I look at that kind of proposal and say that is just not even remotely in the ballpark of a responsible proposal. Before we even go down that route, like you point to, I take a look at our current programs. I take a look at our current trajectories, our current spending trajectories, and let's get those figured out. Let's get those programs on sounder footing, and then let's talk about expanding programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I agree. I think that's what a lot of people know in Wisconsin, especially in my district area, talking. You know, we have to live within our means, and this is a conversation that I think needs to get out even more and more in the public with the media saying, hey, there's not an infinite amount of money. And we are looking for serious issues, especially with, I've got three daughters, the oldest one being 9 years old, you know, what their long-term future is going to be.
That's absolutely right. And that's absolutely, and you know, one of the things that I often hear when I talk with folks in state politics, they say to me, you know, I look at the federal government and they just deficit spend like crazy. And meanwhile, I'm out here budgeting in my state, in Wisconsin or whatever it might be, and I've got to balance a budget. You know, I'm like every other American. I got to live within my means. And you're telling me that in Washington, you can just completely ignore this and just spend and increase deficits and the debt indefinitely? Come on, you know, and I think there's a lot to that. I don't understand why, you know, fiscal discipline should apply in Washington the same way that it applies in just about every other part of our lives.
Yeah, and I know that's one of the biggest, you know, when I'm out talking to people, you know, doing doors or at town halls, that, you know, some people think the state of Wisconsin can print the money like the feds. And I say, no, we got to run the state of Wisconsin like we run our households and the business. So I think that's kind of the disconnect people feel with Washington of, you know, the politicians a lot of times just think they can print money and don't worry about the long-term effects on, you know, the proposals that they want to enact. Kind of moving on, kind of shifting gears a little bit, because I'm from a more rural area. Can you kind of address, you know, some of the issues and some of maybe the ideas we could do to keep make sure that our rural health care has adequate access and has as high quality health care as urban areas?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually think this is one of the areas where states can really meaningfully improve things. So states have a lot of leeway about certain kinds of laws that regulate the supply of healthcare providers. So these are often called things like scope of practice laws or certificate of need laws. So as an example, a certificate of need law basically says that the state requires, you know, certain conditions be met before a new healthcare facility is introduced. Well, if those are overly restrictive, what happens? You don't get a lot of supply. And if you're in a relatively rural area, it's, you know, if you only got one option, boy, prices can be real high. And so you want to do as much as you can to encourage the introduction of competitors. And the same thing goes for scope of practice laws. So these are a set of laws that regulate what can any particular kind of healthcare provider actually do. What can a nurse practitioner do versus a physician? What can a physician's assistant do? What can a nurse anesthetist do? And so there's been a lot of recent evidence that suggests that in many, many cases, these non-physician providers actually produce equally or higher quality care than a physician does. And so I think the evidence suggests that states really need to take a hard look at, is there anything we can do to perhaps expand or relax scope of practice law so that we can take advantage of all these secondary providers that are already here and just let them do more and so encourage more competition that route? I think those are two things I'd look at.
And also, you know, with the telehealth, you know, I know I've been meeting with hospital groups that are really looking to expand. Is this coming more and more nationwide? Is putting more emphasis on the telehealth, especially for the rural areas, to see how we can use the technology in turn should be able to save costs, reduce costs, and, you know, a lot of times maybe even provide a better access for patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a big fan of telehealth. It has its limitations, of course, and I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm somebody who likes using telehealth, and I live in downtown Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. But you know what? If I don't have to go into my physician's office and I can actually do a consult over the phone, that's great. Saves me time, saves me money. And so I'm a big proponent of this, and I think this is one of these things where it's a bit of a newer technology, and, you know, it's probably right to start out a little bit more cautious and implement and roll these things out a little bit more slowly. But as I look into the future in the medium and longer term, I think it's a fantastic opportunity, especially for the rural areas, for the reasons you exactly suggest. However, I'd go further. I think it's a fantastic opportunity for everyone, because anything you can do to save your own time, I value a lot. So I'm a fan, and I think you're exactly right. I think that's something we should be looking forward to in the near future.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. States, you know, we're running an issue in the state of Wisconsin with the Katie Beckett Medicaid program is heavily relied on actual paperwork. They are not in computer systems, even though we have Epic, I think, right from the Capitol, we're at 10 miles away. are there any states that you know of that have kind of jumping on board on, you know, modernizing them? Or is everybody still in the old government bureaucracy of papers, papers, papers all around?
Well, I think one of the things we've seen is you mentioned Epic, and all I can think of is being back at the old fashioned, surrounded by dozens and dozens of Epic employees. So I'm having a bit of a throwback here.
Yeah.
You're 100% right. And this is actually one of these things that has been a bit of a frustration from the perspective of a lot of us in health policy who I think perhaps naively thought that this transition to electronic medical records and just more use of electronic systems would have been a little bit easier and a little bit smoother than it has been. I think while I don't have a specific state in mind, the general feeling that I've heard from folks is that people have been reluctant because of costs. Mm-hmm. And when you hear some of the cost estimates for how much it costs for large academic medical centers to shift everything over to electronic medical records, the cost can be fairly daunting. But at the same time, it's 2019. We shouldn't be faxing all of our medical records around.
Right.
And I think we could all agree on that. You know, it's one of these things that I think, unfortunately, has been more slow to develop than many of us had hoped. My only silver lining here is that, you know, the advantage is newer offices and newer systems all, of course, use these things. And so the hope is that over time we're going to phase most of the paperwork out. But unfortunately, I think in the near term, it's not going to necessarily go away overnight.
Right. So, as policymakers, you know, if there are new programs started or whatever, you know, even small programs that start there and maybe with legislation force them to start the process, so at least we're starting to get the ball rolling, because we know, this is overnight, just take small incremental steps.
That's right. And you know, I think it's important to, you know, especially when you're actually the policymaker who's sitting down thinking about, you know, what the effects of various policies are going to be on your constituents and other Wisconsinites. I mean, you know, for that physician office who's been in business for 25 years, you know, it's pretty tough to actually transition everything. It's quite expensive. And so, you know, you don't want to say, you know, totally discount those concerns. But I think you're right. You know, you try and look in a forward direction and say, how can we at least get this started? And so that in 10 years from now, we'll really be in a much better place than we are right now. And I think your attitude is exactly right.
Yeah. And just kind of with in the news today with the Trump administration, you know, getting rid of the ACA, you know, let's say hypothetically tomorrow ACA goes away. What would you suggest be the first steps a state would take to deal with that situation?
Yeah. So the news today is it's heightened the concern surrounding this issue. As many likely have heard in the news, the Trump administration has basically decided that they're not going to defend the Affordable Care Act, and so it's going through the court systems right now. And the question is, well, will the entire law, the entire ACA, be ruled unconstitutional? At this point, it's going to be very hard for states to absorb the full repeal of the ACA should it happen. I should note that most legal observers think that it's relatively unlikely that the Trump administration is going to actually win this lawsuit. But if we start thinking about moving forward, I think the biggest concern would be the Medicaid expansion states.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there you're going to have an issue where, you know, and this was always one of the concerns, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare included a provision that lets states expand their Medicaid programs and basically said, don't worry about it, the government will pay for this forever. You know, some states looked at that and they said, boy, I'm not sure that's going to be the case. And so we're a little bit reluctant to actually go down that route. And so when I think about what's the worst case for states, especially from a fiscal perspective, the people who actually did go ahead, the states that did go ahead and expand, are going to have one heck of a financial issue on their hands should those subsidies actually go away.
Is there ways, the common ground to reduce healthcare costs? I know we talked about there before. Are there any even more specific ideas of, how suggestions for the state of Wisconsin, since you're from this area, went to school here for a while, that, that we maybe should be looking into on how to maybe implement or work on?
Sure. So there are a variety of different options. I mean, I would go back to your question about, how can we try and encourage high quality, low cost care in rural areas? You know, the ideas of really taking seriously the rules about how hard is it for a new provider, a new doctor's office or a new hospital to be built. I mean, that's something that I think states need to take seriously. And in a lot of states, and while I'm not exactly familiar with where Wisconsin is on that issue, I would go back to our, certificate of need rules and say, geez, do we really need this? And in many cases, there's a strong argument to say, you know what? We really don't. We should let market actors, if they want to enter this market, if they think they can bring in some competition and get some of the patients away from the current incumbent, then we should let them. I don't see why not. And the same goes for how best can we use these healthcare professionals that already exist in our state? All these nurse practitioners, these physician's assistants, how can we get the best use of them? Are we letting them do as much as they're really capable of doing? And in many states, the answer is simply no. And the beauty of that is that many of those other providers are cheaper than having the doctor, an MD, actually do the exact same procedure. And so I would, if I was a policymaker at the state level, I think honestly those would be my two first order issues. Because again, it's hard. So much of healthcare works through the federal government or works through federal state partnerships. And the third thing I would say is as always, there are a few things that are more important to state budgets than Medicaid. And so when it comes to Medicaid, I think most states have tried to aggressively take advantage of the private sector here to their benefit. And so most states have moved towards using what are called managed care organizations rather than the traditional what's called fee-for-service Medicaid. And they do so because they have these private companies who they say, here's X dollars. You've got to figure out a way to be efficient and cost-conscious and treat all these patients. And the results have been that they've been pretty darn good. And so from a budgetary perspective, I would make sure that state Medicaid is running as efficiently as possible and making use of the competitive forces where they can.
Good. And just can you kind of explain surprise medical billing? Because I don't think a lot of people know about this and, the effects of that.
Yeah, sure. So this is we hear about these high-level Medicare for All kind of debates in the news a lot, but actually this is probably the issue that is most likely to get addressed in the near future in Washington. So this is an example where patients expect to be treated by a physician who accepts their insurance, but long after their surgery or their trip to the emergency room, they end up getting a huge bill from somebody who has very high prices that their insurance doesn't pay for. And so the problem, of course, is that if we think about consumers trying to respond to incentives, the person who goes out of their way to try and go to, say, their hospital to have a procedure with an in-network hospital, with an in-network surgeon, but little do they know, the anesthesiologist, the person who literally makes them unconscious, well, that person decided they didn't want to take their insurance. Well, this is something that's gained the attention of policymakers for a bunch of reasons, not the least of which is that, geez, we've got all these consumers making what seems to be the right choice, but they're still getting screwed over with these huge bills. And so what can we do about that? This has attracted attention of the White House and both the House and the Senate. And it's something where we're starting to see congressional hearings on the matter. And I think the overarching goal here is to construct the lightest touch policy that we can, that can both protect consumers from really what I think it's fair to say are fairly pernicious behavior, while at the same time not establishing some sort of large government program to deal with what is a fairly targeted problem that's mostly a problem of a few providers and not really all of the healthcare system.
And, you know, I know we'll be wrapping up here pretty soon. One more question, maybe another follow-up. Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin always get compared. You know, we got very similar demographics in this. And our health care criteria has always been highly rated. Is there either the three states, you know, have key strengths that one should be following the other, or is one doing it better than the other, or do they all have their issues, good and bad?
Well, I like that you asked this question because it reminds me of a comparison that I often get frustrated with, which is you'll hear people compare, well, how does the United States compare to the healthcare of Norway or some tiny homogenous country? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the U.S. is a big place. It's very different. It's got all sorts of different composition and, you know, density and population and demographics and all these things. And so I take that lesson to the states as well. You know, every state has their own challenges, and they have their own even just little things like the urban and rural dynamics of the state, the amount of competition in the state, the density of populations, the, you know, how much insurance competition they have, their wealth, and so on. And so, you know, I try to encourage policymakers, both at the state and the federal level, to try and think independently, not to discount. You know, if you see something working in another state, steal it. You know, I'm all for that. But these cross-state, cross-country comparisons, I think more often than not, they're imperfect enough that it's really hard to learn too much from them. But having said that, you know, I am 100% on board that, you know, states are, of course, the experiments of policymaking. And so if one of those other states has something you think is working, I say steal it.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm glad to see you all are thinking constructively about these issues. I think it's going to be the next big major political cycle, the next presidential election. I think healthcare is going to be one of those issues that is just simply going to be front and center. And so now's the time to start thinking constructively about, you know, how can we actually improve this system as opposed to being stagnant and thinking about relatively unrealistic long-term goals. Let's think pragmatically about how can we actually make Wisconsin healthcare better? How can we make the country's healthcare better?
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there you have it. We have some real bipartisan options to move regulation and governance forward on a state level. We talked about some ways we can implement that and how we can make healthcare more affordable, whether it's making sure we have hospitals in the right locations or whether we have the providers that we need here in Wisconsin to keep costs down. And that's the real focus for Wisconsin Republicans, is keeping those costs in order. We've bent the cost curve over the last few sessions, and we're continuing to focus on that this year. This has been The Right Angle for Wisconsin. Thanks to our intern, Andrew Storrs, for the music, and thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time.